You're listening to the My SBA Loan Pro podcast, hosted by Ryan Smith, principal broker and founder of Think SBA, a one-of-a-kind loan brokerage serving small business owners and entrepreneurs in their quest to purchase real estate, acquire a business or franchise, or obtain working capital. In each episode, Ryan reveals valuable insights and best practices regarding the SBA loan program and application process. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Smith, principal and founder of Think SBA, and welcome to another episode of the My SBA Loan Pro podcast, Face to Face. I'm here today with lower middle market M&A attorney, Jake Parsley. Jake is with the SMB Law Group, and he has practiced law in this space for approximately 14 years. Jake, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me. Excited to talk about some deals here today.
Absolutely. So I'm really excited to have Jake on the podcast. For my listeners, we're going to talk about what an attorney does in an M&A transaction. We're going to talk about how an attorney mitigates risk and really helps facilitate the transaction from beginning to end, protecting the buyer or the seller, making sure that they don't make any major mistakes that they couldn't come back from. Jake, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Originally, I'm a farm kid from South Dakota. I moved to the big city of Minneapolis, which is where I live today for college. Went there for law school and stuck around. That's where my family and I live. And I initially got into practicing law in 2010. My first experience at a firm was with a smaller regional corporate group. So I got exposed to a little bit of everything in the corporate world, a lot of startups, a lot of contract work, some employment law. And I realized that I really liked doing deals. I really liked doing M&A. And so after a few years at that firm, I actually went out and launched my own firm in 2016, focusing almost exclusively on M&A. So you were very generous in your introduction. You referred to me as a lower middle market attorney. I think Main Street would probably be a little more descriptive of the kind of work I do. It tends to be on the shallowest end of the pool, the smaller deals. So I was on my own for quite a few years. And in 2023, I got connected with the guys from SMB Law Group. If you're on Twitter at all, you know who they are. There's some big personalities there. And they also are doing the same thing. They were focused exclusively on M&A, and they were really designing products and services around business buyers and sellers in the far lower middle market and Main Street space. So I joined up with them and been working with them ever since. So yeah, really kind of got most of my deal training on the Main Street side. Whereas a lot of people in this space, they start out at bigger firms, they train in doing private equity and publicly traded deals and gradually work their way smaller. I was kind of the opposite. I started out doing very small deals, and over time and experience, I've grown to take on more complicated and larger deals.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. And I can tell you that as an SBA loan broker working on these transactions, I have known several attorneys over the past several years. And like you said, Jake, they typically want to work on bigger deals. And so it's been difficult to find attorneys who consider Main Street SBA borrowing and transactions their bread and butter. And so when I joined X, what I would call full time in May of last year, and saw the SMB Law Group on Twitter, I was fascinated by a group of attorneys who would purposely go into the Main Street space. But you know, based on what I've seen, your volume was like last year. You guys have done, number one, you've done a great job in helping individuals. Number two, you've carved out a really nice amount of work for yourselves. And if this is accurate and true, that we're going to see this type of activity maintain itself over the next 10, 15 years, or maybe even longer, this is a great place or a great space to play in. So Jake, that brings me to the first question. What does an attorney do in an M&A transaction?
Yeah, great question. And really what it boils down to is an attorney is a part of your deal team that focuses on mitigating risk, right? That's our goal. We're mitigating risk. We're not generally super involved in the numbers and finding the business and assessing whether the deal is being done for a fair price. Although we have exposure to these things all the time. That's really more for people like you. What we're trying to do is, number one, if there's existing problems, making sure that they're addressed up front, hopefully headed off before we get to the closing table. But ultimately, through all that paperwork that lawyers do over the course of a deal, we're setting things up so that if something goes wrong, there is recourse for that buyer or recourse for that seller if something goes wrong after the closing that wasn't anticipated. So risk mitigation, that's kind of our number one job.
Got it. Yeah. And when I'm working with a borrower, and again, I work with borrowers, so I work on the buy side solely. When I'm working with them, a lot of times the question comes up, when should I engage an attorney and what is that attorney really going to do for me? And one of their major concerns, again, we're at the Main Street level. One of their major concerns is cost. And so if you could talk about when an individual should, on the buy side, should engage your services and what should they expect from a cost perspective?
Yeah. So in a perfect world, attorneys, we have a very high view of ourselves, right? And so the common answer that you'll see a lot is engage an attorney early and often, right? And some attorneys will go so far as to say, always have an attorney review your NDAs, have an attorney review every LOI that you submit. In a perfect world where cost is no issue, I guess I would tend to agree with that advice. But the reality is, in these Main Street deals, you have to be cognizant of your transactional costs. And you also have to know that you're going to take a lot of swings and there's going to be a lot of misses. And broken deal costs can bring a searcher with limited funds to their knees, really, over the course of a few of them. So if you're in all likelihood, your first LOI is not going to be your last, especially if it's a good business that's competitive. You're going to be competing against potentially deeper pockets, more attractive offers. And so our general rule of thumb, or my general rule of thumb, I don't want to speak for anyone else, is if you're comfortable with NDAs, if you're comfortable with LOIs, you can handle those yourself, especially if you're being cognizant of costs. I make an LOI template available to anyone that wants one. Obviously, if you have questions, if you're uncomfortable, you should go back and talk to an attorney. Don't ever sign anything that you're uncomfortable with or that you don't fully understand. And a good attorney is going to talk with you in an efficient way and work through those concerns. But where I really love to see on a Main Street deal someone get me involved is after they're under LOI and after they've done that preliminary due diligence, right? And they've connected with partners like you, so they have a good handle on how their financing is going to be structured. And they've also, they're sure that the business is what they think it is, that this is the business that they want, that there's meat on that bone, right? That we've gone beyond the sometimes skeletal SIM or maybe slightly misleading SIM in some circumstances. And we know that we've actually verified the financials of the business. Now it makes sense to engage legal and start spending money on that when there's a fair amount of certainty regarding the business that's being acquired.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. So let's just walk through the life cycle of a deal. Let's say I'm contacted by, and this happens all the time, I'm contacted by a buyer. We have our conversation about the financing, and then they need to contact the either listing broker or the seller directly. And once they do that, now, even though they don't know it, they're in negotiations, right? And so the question invariably comes up, hey, Ryan, when should I engage an attorney? And Jake, you hit the nail on the head. Most searchers, and now they're going to be different types of searchers, right? There's going to be very sophisticated ones who want full service. So before they even talk to the listing broker or the seller, they're going to engage an attorney. Maybe they don't really care about the billable hours, right? Maybe they're in a different economic space. But I would say for me, 95% of my Main Street transactions, the buyer's very cognizant of the costs and when to start the billing. And so what I tell them is, just like you said, Jake, right? Let's get through the preliminaries. Let's discuss the transaction with the listing broker and the seller. And when I say let's, I don't discuss anything with the seller or the listing broker, but they can do most of that on their own. Mm-hmm. But then we come to that LOI. And what we're talking about here is a letter of intent. It's a preliminary document that what it does is it establishes the ground rules of the transaction from a legal perspective, but it is not the purchase agreement. So again, the LOI letter of intent is a preliminary document. It establishes the ground rules. Jake, you have done an amazing job in providing me with a letter of intent that I can send to searchers who get to that point and want to quote unquote lock down the opportunity. But before I had this document in my hand, I didn't have anything to give them and said, hey, you need to go speak with someone like Jake. So Jake, can you tell us what that LOI should include to make sure that the buyer is moving forward and isn't going to get the rug pulled out from under them?
Yeah, yeah. That LOI is a critical step, but at the same time, it's just a step, right? Like you called it, you know, it's one step in that process. To me, the description I like to use is it's effectively a handshake with a few extra legal things built into it, right? And it's going to be very transaction dependent. If you're going after something that's more middle market, then yes, you are going to make yourself look better as a prospective buyer by having a nuanced, detailed LOI with landmarks. And maybe you want some attorney assistance there, right? Like you mentioned, for some people, maybe you've got investor capital, or maybe you've got enough of a, you know, of a financial base underneath you that you don't mind paying for some expert assistance on this. I guess my message to those who are downstream from that are doing the smaller deals, looking at a Main Street deal, is your brokers and your sellers tend to be looking at a couple of things, most of it being the number, right? What are you going to give me for this business and how are you going to pay it to me? So price and terms we want spelled out in an LOI in a non-binding format, right? We want to be able to, we don't want to, and hopefully everything checks out and we can negotiate based off of those terms and close a deal based on the terms if what the broker has represented to us is accurate, the business broker, excuse me. And then from a legal perspective, what I really want though is exclusivity. And I want that to be legally binding. I want that to be spelled out crystal clear in my LOI that while we are under LOI for whatever that period is, and I encourage our searchers to get it for as long as they can, 60 days, 90 days, sometimes you can only get 30 or 20 or something like that. But while it's under exclusivity and while that searcher is really doing their homework and digging into that business, doing their financial diligence, talking to financing partners, investing time and money, that no one else is going to swoop in and take that business away. And especially in today's business market where there are searchers everywhere across the country shooting out, unsolicited offers to buy businesses, you can't be too safe. You know, I even have deals where sellers are selling to their employees. And I generally love these situations, right? Because the buyer has got a huge leg up on their financial due diligence. There's usually some trust involved there. But I still like to get legally binding exclusivity because, you know, if you're negotiating with your boss to buy that business for $1 million and all of a sudden private equity swoops in with a $3 million offer, you know, that can be a real temptation for that seller. So I just can't be clear enough. Exclusivity is the biggest concern that I have with an LOI. Number two being basic deal parameters and a purchase price that you can live with if everything is as represented. Once we get past that LOI, now we can do our financial diligence. And if we need to walk some of those or change some of those terms, I'm sure you've seen this happen with some of your lending partners. Once they get into the financials and they get a little bit more detail, well, now we need the seller to carry a little bit more in the form of a seller note, right? To help us get the deal across the finish line. Or in other circumstances, there's other levers that we can pull to make things work. But as long as we can provide a basis for doing so, we can change the terms in an LOI without it being considered, you know, a naked retrade. And retrade, of course, is a dirty word in M&A circles where it's a buyer changing the terms of the deal when they're close to the finish line, just because they can, just because they have that extra leverage at that point in time and they're trying to save a buck. I don't advise that. But I do think if you need to renegotiate based on new information, you should be able to do that as long as you can educate the seller on why you're doing what you're doing.
And you brought up a good point about a seller note. What I'd like you to do is talk to the listener about a seller note, what you believe it's validity in the transaction is. I mean, some people think absolutely you have to have one. Some people aren't as staunch. Most of the time I see a seller note is included in a business transfer transaction. And then if you can talk about the deposit, what do you see out there as far as a realistic amount that a seller should ask a buyer to deposit to engage the transaction, and then talk about it being refundable versus non-refundable, and then also the time period that an individual should have for that deposit, if it's refundable, to be returned back to the buyer.
Yeah. So I'll take those one at a time. Let's start with the seller note, right? As a risk mitigation tool, I love seller notes, because really what that does is the seller note being a portion of the purchase price that is paid to the seller. It's also called seller financing or seller carry. There's a few different words that get used that they all mean the same thing. For example, if I'm buying a business for $1 million and I get an $800,000 loan and I'm contributing $100,000, a lot of times, you know, then that extra $100,000 could come in the form of a seller note with any number of different terms attached to it, right? So I like that as a risk mitigation tool because, for one thing, it helps us align incentives. It incentivizes the seller to assist with the transition, because they've still got $100,000 out there in our example, or any dollar amount that's out there that the seller is going to, you know, they in all likelihood are not going to get paid that amount unless the business continues successfully after the closing. It's going to be subordinated to the SBA debt, which means that it is second in rank behind the SBA debt, or really any kind of senior debt that exists. And so it really encourages the seller to continue to cooperate with the buyer. And we love aligning those incentives long-term. The other thing is that if something goes wrong with the business after the closing, what we push for in all of our deals, and we push hard for this, is we call an ability to offset the seller note. So to break that down into an example, if I've got a $100,000 seller note, and I will put language in the purchase agreement that basically spells out, if something goes wrong after the closing that's the seller's fault and is a breach of our purchase agreement, any losses that I have, I take that amount and I can, as the buyer, deduct it from the amount that I owe the seller. So under our example, I owe the seller $100,000 after closing. Let's say I'm going to pay it over the course of 5 years, fully amortized. And I then have a loss because a seller has a warranty claim for something that the seller did prior to closing, and I have to pay that customer, or I have to incur costs of $50,000. I document those costs and I notify the seller, look, there was this problem with the business that I bought that wasn't disclosed. It represents a breach under our purchase agreement. I'm going to deduct that $50,000 loss that I just took against the seller note. Now, if I don't have a seller note and that same situation arises, now I've got a situation where I've incurred a $50,000 loss because of something that the seller has done that's the seller's fault. And now I'm sending an email or calling the seller and saying, hey, I just incurred a $50,000 loss. Can you pay me back for that? And as you can imagine, the seller, who may or may not be on a beach right at this point in time, somewhere in maybe lovely San Diego, might not be real quick to get back to me on that one. And it can really be a fight. It's a lot easier to negotiate those types of resolutions when you have some of the seller's money still in your pocket.
Very good.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I love what you said there. You know, it gives you leverage post-close. I always say, buyers, you have so much risk on the table because the seller, in most instances, is taking 90 to 95% of the risk off the table. They're exiting. And then the buyer is the one who's left with the business. And hopefully the business financials have been represented accurately. But we all know that they're probably not being represented accurately to 100%. And whether you bring in a quality of earnings expert or not depends on whether or not you have a high level of certainty of what you're getting. And so let's say you forgo that expense and now you're sitting there with this business. And like you said, something that was repped in the contract is not accurate, or a customer comes back. There are so many different scenarios. Now you have leverage to go back to the seller. Let's talk about the deposit. I see different perspectives on X, whether you should put in a deposit, whether you shouldn't. Me personally, I always look at it from both ends of the spectrum. So if I'm the seller, I definitely want a deposit because, like you said, there's so many searchers out there. If they can just sign an LOI and tie up your business, I don't think that's a good practice. But at the same time, I don't think that deposit should be 10% of the transaction, especially if it's like a $5 million transaction. I think it should be, in my opinion, $5,000 to $10,000. I'd love to hear what you have to say. And obviously, it should be refundable, tied to a due diligence contingency or a financing contingency, which can be 30, 60, 90 days, whatever the buyer and the seller can negotiate. And what that enables the buyer to do is do their due diligence, get their financing formally in order, And then if everything checks out, they move forward, they remove the contingency. What is your opinion on the deposit? How much should it be, and refundable or non-refundable?
Yeah. So I'm going to take things from a buy side perspective, right? Which tends to be a lot of our clients. I, in a perfect world, I prefer to have my clients not put down a deposit, right? And what I encourage them to, and I understand the perspective, you know, like you brought up, the seller is taking some risk by pulling their business off the market. They're putting information at risk, even though we're under a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA, there's still risk there, right? As they start to share information under LOI. And so, you know, what I tell people is I prefer to tell that seller and even demonstrate to that seller that you're a serious buyer, that rather than lock that money up in an escrow account or a trust account, I would much rather take that money and spend it on due diligence and spend it on resources that indicate I'm serious and I want to move this deal forward. I don't want to be parking my operating capital, you know, my acquisition capital in an escrow account where I don't have access to it. But I also tell them, let's keep the big picture in mind. If you are, you know, hot to trot on a real great looking HVAC company that's, you know, going for $2 million, everybody wants an HVAC company that's, you know, that's doing 750 in revenue for 750 in earnings for, you know, a couple million bucks. You're not going to make your offer more competitive by digging in your heels and fighting that earnest money deposit. So, you know, sometimes it's just, you got to pay to play. And in which case I just tell people, make darn sure that you're clear about what's going to happen with that earnest money deposit. And really what I find is that the brokers tend to, business brokers have a tendency to either care a ton about this, or maybe they don't care so much. If they are coming from the middle market down towards Main Street, they're not used to earnest money deposits being, you know, something that's part of every deal. If they're a former real estate agent and they've now gotten into the business brokerage world, they bring that idea with them and they say, well, we've got to see skin in the game, right? We want to see skin in the game. Well, sometimes it's easier to just play along with them, protect the cash that you're putting up, and just move forward and, you know, do whatever you got to do to get that deal under LOI and really dig in and find out if it's the right thing for you. Pay very close attention to your deadlines though, right? And because sometimes we do see 10% in earnest money over the course of a deal, which is a huge amount. I really think it puts you at a disadvantage from a leverage perspective as a buyer when you've put that much money up. Because the reality of the situation is, and I've not seen this happen very often, but if whoever is holding those funds, you know, if it's a buyer and a seller, if it's the seller's broker that's holding those funds and they decide that they just don't want to turn those over to you or that they have some right to keep them, then you have to fight over it. You have to go hire a litigation attorney now and spend a bunch of money to try to get that money back. And it's just a really nasty situation. And I've seen it. I mean, I worked on a real estate deal one time where my client, in my opinion, very reasonable, decided to pull the plug on a deal and they had 20K in earnest money and the seller said they weren't going to give it back to him. And so my client was actually forced to go hire a litigation attorney to initiate litigation over a $20,000 pot of money. And I think the other thing that I just want to emphasize, circling back to the seller note, while we're on the topic of litigation being prohibitively expensive in the small business context, is that's really another advantage of the seller note, is that on a small deal, let's say you're buying a business for $600,000. And you know, if you don't have a seller note and you've got a loss of $50,000 or $60,000 as a percentage of the deal, that's a huge, huge deal. That's a huge problem. But it's frankly not going to be worth litigating over. And so you're generally probably going to end up eating that loss or potentially throwing good money after bad in the form of litigation. Whereas if you have a seller note and you have some of seller's money in your pocket, you at least have a tool with which to negotiate, right? You, at that point in time, now you can go to the seller and say, look, I don't want to litigate. You don't want to litigate. I've got this problem and I've also got some of your money. How can we work this out? Right. And then we can reach a situation where it's not probably a win-win because we're dealing with a negative situation post-closing, but you at least aren't taking the entire short end of the stick on the deal.
And as far as sellers go, so for example, how often do you see by a percentage where sellers will concede no deposit and then also talk about how open sellers are to the seller note as well?
Yeah. So a couple of things. every deal is so different, right? A lot of times sellers, if they don't have a business broker, they might not have ever even thought about a seller note before, right? They might not have heard of it because it's not the kind of thing that we see in real estate transactions, right? Certainly not residential real estate transactions, which I think most people, their frame of reference for a business deal, the closest thing they have to it is when they bought or sold a house. So with that being said, if the buyer can educate the seller, it's not going to take a lot of homework for a seller to realize, oh yeah, on a Main Street transaction, seller financing is a very common component to this deal. And I think if you're trying to sell a seller on it, you think of like, what are some other advantages of the seller note? Well, you know, you can spread out your tax bill. It's a little bit like an annuity. You can continue to, you know, generate some income off that. Most of the seller notes that we're seeing now are doing returns better than what they're going to get, even in like a high interest savings account. So, you know, there's some financial upside to the seller in the form of a seller note. And I think the biggest thing is that a business with a seller note component, largely probably due to the risk mitigation that we've been talking about, will bring a higher premium in the marketplace. And so brokers tend to encourage that seller note because business brokers I'm talking about here, of course, they like that seller. And, you know, I assume the loan brokers are okay with it too. But the business broker wants that higher sale price, right? Because they're getting paid at the closing table based on gross proceeds, and they could care less when the seller gets paid. I'm being a little cynical here, but they just want to see that higher purchase price because that's what's going to determine what their commission is. And so generally, I think, and the other thing too, is the longer a business sits, the more the reality sets in for that seller that if they want a particular price for the business, they have to carry some of it back in the form of a seller note, right? And I've seen deals where businesses can't move unless the seller carries the entire purchase price in the form of a note, really. And that to me, you know, there should be other warning bells that go off if that's happening, but in the right circumstances, it is something that I've seen 100% seller note, you know, on a handful of deals in the last few years.
And as far as the deposit goes, how often do you see sellers concede to no buyer deposit heading into due diligence?
Yeah, it is something that, again, most of my buyers I encourage to not fight too hard for it, but a lot of times it can kind of just fall by the wayside, where we just don't give them the deposit and then they just don't ask for it and they can see that we're making progress and it just sort of gets forgotten about. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is if it really is important, like if there's a legitimate issue of trust and maybe we really need that money to pay for a Q of E and we don't have investors and we're trying to finance a deal by ourselves, we just tell them that we can't do it. And I think the harder we push, if we have the leverage, right? If the seller isn't got seven other offers where they're happy to put up earnest money, they'll go along with it, but it's not a guarantee. And sometimes brokers or sellers will dig in their heels and say, we're not moving forward without earnest money. In which case, my information to the buyer is, you got to make a decision. Do you want this opportunity? Because if you do, you got to lock up some funds. And in which case, let's just protect those funds to the extent that we can.
Yeah. Talk to the audience about the difference between a letter of intent and the purchase agreement. And then if you can dovetail off of that, what should be in the purchase agreement that maybe isn't in the letter of intent that will really help go a long way toward mitigating risk post-close once they have the business?
Yeah, great. So the LOI, again, like we say, is kind of our deal process and some high-level terms, right? Sometimes you see LOIs where they really sort of, it's almost like a purchase agreement light, right? Where they are putting they say what the purchase agreement will include, and then they'll include like, you know, a quick list of all the basic reps and warranties and non-compete terms and things of that nature. If any of those terms are material to a deal and important to move that deal forward, by all means, I think it's good to include that in an LOI, especially if a seller has indicated that that is particularly important to them. Or if the seller, for example, gives you cause for concern as a buyer, like if you know up front, the seller is 32 years old and they're selling a company that's doing gangbusters and you don't really understand why, you might want to go ahead and let them know you're going to ask for a 5+ year non-compete up front. Just to make sure that they're aware that you are not going to move forward with this deal unless you can be assured of that critical non-compete component being included in the deal. But other than that, really, again, exclusivity and basic deal terms are what I want to see in an LOI. and then we can move forward and cover everything else in the purchase agreement. I think one area where this, and this can be a pro or a con, is working capital being included in a LOI. My basic template LOI includes a reference to a normalized amount of working capital being included in the price. And it is intended to not cause friction at an early stage, but also to plant the seed that we are expecting there to be some working capital coming with this business, whether that be in the form of inventory or AR or whatever. But the farther you go down on Main Street, as soon as you start talking about net working capital, eyes glaze over. Brokers get concerned that they are talking to a private equity buyer in disguise, and it really makes things difficult. And you might have, and that might make you seem like a difficult buyer and move your LOI to the bottom of the stack while they go talk to people that will make an easier meal for them, right? So I do think it's important to include a reference, because it is difficult if you submit an LOI that doesn't reference inventory or any kind of working capital language, and then you come back at the purchase agreement stage and tell them that you expect there to be a normalized amount of inventory included. That now can get to be difficult. It can erode trust if they feel like, again, if they feel like you're retrading at this point in time. So I guess the long story short is I do advocate for there being some reasonable amount of critical detail in the LOI, but not getting to the point where we want to, I see LOIs where they're saying, this is how long the reps and warranties are going to last for, or like, we're going to ask for indemnifications with these types of caps and baskets. That's okay to include, but it's not going to make you look like a more attractive buyer, especially in a Main Street bidding, you know, auction type situation. So I say, let's leave all that stuff for the PA and cross that bridge when we get there. Because frankly, if the deal falls apart during financial due diligence, I would have rather not argued over 100 different things in the LOI and saved us all the trouble. Recently I was working on a deal, and here's what the problem with lawyers, and I'm including myself in this example. When we see something we don't like, even if it's in a non-binding LOI, we cannot help ourselves but redline that thing and send it back and say, I don't like this idea. I know it's non-binding, but let's just change it so that they understand we're gonna change this right now. I was doing this. I was on my third round of revisions in an LOI, and the accountant sent an email, and he said, it's an LOI, period. Get it signed, period. And that was, and he's like, we'll dig into the business later. And now that's, be a little cautious of that. And it's always going to be deal specific, but there's an element of truth there. You have to get the business under LOI in order to ever buy a business, and you will not get it under LOI faster by including onerous amounts of detail.
Is there a case for not going to LOI? Again, I see on Twitter, some people say, hey, forget the LOI, go straight to purchase agreement. Are you a thumbs up or a thumbs down on that? And really quickly, why or why not?
Yeah. So I am an advocate of it in the right circumstances, right? For example, I'm buying a business from my boss. There's a high degree of trust. We've established all the terms, and I'm not going to be doing any outside due diligence. I'm not going to be hiring a Q of E. What is an LOI going to establish? I mean, I'm going to ask my client for what the deal terms are to draft a PA. And, if there's a bullet point list that's gone back and forth by email where they've both said, these are the terms, let's just go ahead and go to a PA. Right. And, I think what I see a lot of times, and what I don't like though, is when we progress to a PA, when we are legitimately at an arm's length transaction and the buyer and seller don't know each other, and the broker is pushing for, and I don't know how common this is. It's pretty common with a few brokerage shops locally. They want a signed PA that is effectively like a LOI on steroids, except it's a purchase agreement. It's a legally binding document. And they say, well, just sign this. It's a fill in the blank form, but it's legally binding. And I don't like that. I don't like signing legally binding documents that commit me to anything unless I have a full understanding of what I'm committing to. And we're just not there at the LOI stage on an arm's length transaction, which is why, yes, we'll commit to confidentiality. Yes, we'll commit to exclusivity. But beyond that, we're not committing to anything else, except we're going to commit to learn more about each other and be prepared to stand behind the representations I made in the non-binding section regarding purchase price.
Yeah. And in my business, I know, for example, almost everything, not everything, and things are always changing in the SBA standard operating procedure manual. So the mm-hmm. SOP, right? And mm-hmm. you're an attorney, so it's your job to know the law. But you and I both know that when we represent individuals in these transactions, we learn things that are off the books, right? We learn things about a transaction, whether it be personalities, nuance, things that you can't read in a law book, things that you can't read in the SOP. Can you talk to the listeners about those intangibles in the transaction that you've seen that can really hurt someone down the line if they don't address it immediately?
Yeah, I think the number one intangible, and I can't emphasize this enough, is trust, right? The buyer has to be able to trust that seller. And if at any point you have reason to not trust the seller, especially if you've caught them in a lie or anything like that, I really encourage my sellers to, or my buyers, excuse me, to cut bait on that deal and get out of there and find something else. And to go to the other end of the spectrum, I've had deals where I don't like the other lawyer. I don't like the terms of the deal at all, but my clients have a high degree of trust with the seller. And a lot of times we can identify specifically what's happening here. Seller is using an attorney that is not a deal attorney, that doesn't understand market terms, and they're asking for unreasonable requests. But the seller doesn't know that's being unreasonable, and the business remains sound. And so my buyers, I'll warn them about what I don't like from a legal perspective. But if they say, you know what, we still like the business, we trust the seller, we're going to just go ahead and ignore whatever those non-market terms are and get this deal closed. And I don't love when that happens, but at the same time, these entrepreneurs are risk takers. They're putting up a lot of money and a personal guarantee, obligating themselves to pay back an enormous debt in order to run a business. And if they want to take a risk on that, even if the legal terms might not be reflective of the broader marketplace, I'm not going to stop them. I'm just going to make sure they understand and they're going in with eyes wide open. But trust, to me, it makes all, and what I really like is on a sell side deal where I trust my client that's a seller and the buyer trusts them. And I just know in my heart of hearts that they're going to stand by their word. They're going to do what's right. And also they're going to get paid a lot of cash at the closing table. If they decide that they want to honor a warranty claim down the road and I trust them on that, I don't think that's going to be a problem. So I can't speak enough about trust. I think trust is probably the single most critically important intangible aspect of a deal.
Awesome. Well, Jake, thank you so much for being here. You've provided a lot of great information. I can't wait to post this. So this is your opportunity to pitch the thousands of people who listen and watch the My SBA Loan Pro podcast face-to-face to engage you when they are buying or selling a business. Give them your contact information, when they should contact you, and how they should contact you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it, Ryan. Really appreciate the opportunity. I always enjoy talking deals, especially getting into the nitty-gritty beyond the nuts and bolts of a deal that you can find in a business buying book. I'm with SMB Law Group. You can find me on X. You can find me on LinkedIn, Jake Parsley. My email address is jake@smblaw.group. We only do deals. We are deal attorneys. I'm kind of the main street guy in the group, so I would love to talk with you about your smaller deal. We try to do everything we can on a flat fee and remove some of those concerns around infinity billable hours on deals. But reach out to us by all means. We're happy to talk deals. And Ryan, really appreciate the opportunity to come on your podcast.
Thank you again, Jake. I really appreciate it. And you have a great day.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for listening to the My SBA Loan Pro podcast. Be sure to like, share, subscribe, and leave a review. But most importantly, we hope you'll use this information to start your SBA loan journey today by texting or calling us at 858-762-2774 or completing our online application at mysba.pro/app. That's mysba.pro/app. We look forward to working with you.